The Unbearable Loneliness of Mr. Milchick, written by Plaid Adder, and read by Wilfriede 0815. Fandom, Severance. And the Severance meta keeps on coming. Today we're going to speculate about the interiority of Lumen's most overworked and undervalued manager, Seth Milchick. Spoilers for everything up through the Season 2 episode Attila. Of all the weird things about the severed floor of Lumen Industries, Mr. Milchick's effect might be the weirdest. Harmony Corbell is definitely messed up, but we're given more information about why. She's clearly gone all in on the Lumen cult. It seems like she might believe that she owes her life to them based on that coil of hospital tubing she put in her shrine and carries with her when she flees. And the way she goes from flat to furious in under 60 milliseconds is terrifying, but it's not unfamiliar. What the fuck is going on inside Mr. Milchick has always been a much harder question to answer. Clearly his relationship with Miss Corbell was antagonistic, and he does let us see how glad he is that she's gone. His attitude toward the innies he manages is harder to figure. Every once in a while, in Season 1, he would offer up some moment of genuineness to one or more of the innies. How much he loves seeing the sunrise on the giant bas relief of Keir Egan's face, how much he enjoys seeing you all come in like this, etc. But you never know whether to trust them. At times in Season 1, I felt like he viewed the innies, basically, as fictional characters in a beloved TV show. As for instance when he tells Mark S. that he and Petey were one of his favorite office friendships. It's pretty clear that he routinely lies to and manipulates the innies. And from his exchange with Corbell about the painting in The Grim Barbarity of Optics and Design, it appears that there is a manual for managers that outlines an endless variety of manipulation protocols to use in different situations. The Season 1 finale also shed some light on his interactions with Helena/Helly. We can now see that he is sucking up to Helena at every possible opportunity. The flowers for her first day, telling her that when he heard she was coming it was like the answer to a prayer. A more complicated point to revisit is Helly's marathon first stint in the break room. On a first viewing, his suppressed but still visible distress at her failure to mean it when she reads the compunction statement for the 750th time makes it seem like there might be a bit of real compassion left in him for a young trainee who's getting her spirit broken for the first time. Knowing that he knows that he's torturing Helena Egan's innie makes me more inclined to assume that he's mainly distressed about his own peril and sad about how long his own torment is going to continue. Does Milchick believe in his work or enjoy it? Or is he still at Lumen because he's trapped there? Is he burned out, or is he still trying? Does he want the innies to like and trust him, or does he not care as long as they comply? Is there still a person under his corporate shell? These are just some of the questions that Season 1 raised that I felt like I could never really answer. But Season 2 is filling in the picture a little bit. Attila, an episode which is mainly about Irving, is actually the most clarifying so far when it comes to who, if anyone, Milchick really is. The episode title obviously references Bird, but we can also see it as referring to Milchick's attempt to adopt a more aggressive management style. With everything else that's going on, for my money, the most unsettling scene in Attila is the one with Milchick in the supply closet laboriously re-paperclipping all his daily logs. And then, terrifyingly, trying to use a mirror to teach himself how to not use long words. At the beginning, he's role-playing the conversation with Miss Huang, but at some point during the reduction, he shifts to berating himself. Grow up. Grow up. Grow. Grow. So, what's it like to be Milchick? I think the best clue we have is his response to the reproach about the kindness reforms he instituted. I'm not Corbell. It's the first real indication we get that he really sees a meaningful difference between the way he treats the innies and the way she treats them. It raises the possibility that Milchick actually believes in kindness as a management strategy, and that some of his more bizarre innovations, the 5-minute dance experience, the melon bar, the new break room and its absolute insane stop-motion animation fake history of the Macrodata Rebellion, may be sincere attempts to sustain any self-esteem or morale. From that point of view, the fact that all of these kindness reforms, like everything Milchick does on that floor, are also manipulation and gaslighting arises less from Milchik's intentions than from his refusal to understand that nothing he does will mitigate the profound injustice of the system he perpetuates. He's willing to do almost anything to keep them happy, except tell them the truth, give them agency, or help them escape this hell. Another thing that Attila confirms for us is that as long as he is at Lumen, Milchik is not going to have many opportunities to grow, personally or professionally. The gift of the inclusive Egan portraits is... the moment that Natalie presented those to him must have broken the needle on Milchik's get-out-o-meter. He does not, in fact, enjoy seeing himself reflected in these masterpieces, and the fact that someone up the chain in Lumen evidently thought that he would makes him that much more isolated and afraid. Maybe the ORTBO was a response to that sudden consciousness of how alone he really is in there. He has no real help. Miss Huang is great at surveillance but doesn't seem useful in any other capacity. And he has put quite a lot of effort into organizing this complex and apparently unprecedented weekend activity. I still think that there is no fourth appendix, and that Milchik just created the Tale of Dieter Egan for his little homebrew D&D module. When that fails, he makes a desperate attempt to appeal to Natalie. Natalie! The only character on the show whose interior is even harder to detect than Milchik's. But it's possible that he wasn't wrong to try it. When Natalie presents him with the paintings, she describes how she responded to them and why. Now, this could be just more proof that Natalie's entire soul has been colonized by the Egans, but it also could be Natalie trying to do Milchik a solid by telling him what the desired response to this gift is so that he can perform it. And that does work. It's one of the few positives mentioned at his performance review. Her response to his attempt at outreach is just to smile bigger and harder, which, on the one hand, is a response to everything, but on the other hand, does start to seem a little extra. But of course, neither of them can really communicate in Lumen, because they can't shake the surveillance they've internalized. Some fan theories posit that, like Miss Huang, probably, Milchik was taken into Lumen as a child and therefore his whole identity has been made out of Lumen conditioning. I suppose one day we might find out. In the meantime, I feel like I now know better how to read things like his showing up at the elevator for Mark S. with a big bunch of blue balloons with his face on them. These are things you would do for people if you wanted to help them feel good enough to go back to work, and if you didn't really understand human emotions. So, maybe the ORTBO was Milchik's idea. My counter-theory is that Helena set the whole thing up for the express purpose of getting to have sex with Mark S. On verra. Maybe he's desperately attempting not just to get compliance from the innies, but to make them a happy workplace family again. Maybe he's genuinely outraged by Helena's blasphemy against the Book of Dieter Egan, which he so carefully crafted for his team-building exercise. Maybe he's genuinely disappointed that they don't get to toast those Kier Egan marshmallows. Maybe the struggle between Milchik the kindness reformer and Milchik the apparatchik whose only goal is self-advancement is real. Or maybe I'm allowing myself to be played by a guy who, at the end of season one, is seriously trying to get Dylan to trade his soul for a coffee cozy. The end.